We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
You're listening to the Dana and Parks podcast on KMBZ.
This just cleared on Fox News, so you know it's true. A longtime Memorial Day, by the way, Memorial Day is a week from today. A longtime Memorial Day weekend tradition to honor veterans is now canceled due to the coronavirus pandemic. But there are persisting calls to bring it back. For decades, the Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, other groups have devoted part of the holiday to place small American flags at the graves of veterans and those who have given the ultimate sacrifice as a way to honor our country's war heroes. Yet this year, the Department of Veterans Affairs has announced they are prohibiting public events at the sites because of COVID-19. The Boy Scouts and other groups are now barred from carrying out the mass flag placements. Now, I'm curious about this one. The flags are put there, obviously, prior to Memorial Day. They're left there for several days. Why can't somebody come by and pick them up with gloves on and when it's time to put them back in a bag or whatever? The Boy Scouts could put them on with gloves on?
I don't know. That seems like something you could do with one or two people and socially distance and be fine. I don't know.
No, I mean, there are so, Dana, there are so many tombstones. I mean, you can't do it with, like, one or two people. But, I mean, you need dozens of people to put those flags out because...
But you could do it in shifts the night before or 2 days before.
But you would need a lot of Boy Scouts to do it. And Girl Scouts. I don't want to take anything away from them. But I don't know why they couldn't put the flags out with gloves on, maybe a mask on if necessary. I don't know. And then, you know, I know full well come next Monday I am not going to Leavenworth and attending a Memorial Day service. Now, I will go to Leavenworth next Monday and I'll visit my dad. But I know that the service is, I mean, it's gone. There's no way. So I'll go there and, you know, sit at his tombstone, say a couple nice words, and go about my business. But this will be the first year in 15 years that we haven't gone for the service.
For the service.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Scott, do you see who passed away over the weekend? Ken Osmond. Does that ring a bell to you?
No.
He passed over the weekend at the age of 76. And maybe Sam will give you a hint here. Ken Osmond was best known for his role as Haskell on Leave It to Beaver.
Old Haskell died?
Eddie Haskell at the age of 76.
No kidding.
Died at his Los Angeles home surrounded by family members. They did not release a cause of death. Quoting here from his son, he was an incredibly kind and wonderful father. He had his family gathered around him when he passed. He was loved and will be missed. Leave It to Beaver finished its run, Scott, in 1963. Mm-hmm. He returned a couple of times for, like, you know, anniversary specials about the hit show. But listen to this. He, after his acting career, went on to work for the Los Angeles Police Department in 1970 and grew a mustache recognizable. In 1980, he was actually shot in a chase with a suspected car thief, though his bulletproof vest saved him. He was put on disability and retired from the force in 1988. So Eddie Haskell, the world's most well-known troublemaker in film,
yes,
ended up being a Los Angeles police officer. How about that?
I mean, to this day, and I wasn't even alive when Leave It to Beaver was on the air, but my brother looks so much like Beaver Cleaver that his nickname to this day is Beaver, my brother. We still call him Beaver. And Eddie Haskell has always been, in my family at least, I don't know about yours, if anybody that we grew up with was a troublemaker, we always say, well, you know, he was kind of like the Eddie Haskell.
He was kind of an Eddie Haskell. Everybody said that. I can't think of very many characters in television who the name of the character goes on to become an adjective that is so around the world known. If you said, well, that kid's a real Eddie Haskell, you would know that your mom and dad did not want you around that kid.
I mean, I've even said that about some of my kids' friends. I'm like, well, you know, they're kind of like the Eddie Haskell. And that just – Eddie Haskell translates into troublemaker.
And also translates into someone who is super nice. Well, thank you, Mrs.
To your
Cleaver.
Face.
You are looking lovely in that apron today, Mrs. Cleaver.
Now,
and then would turn around
and
say something behind your back.
Mm-hmm. Let's go smoke some dope.
76 years old.
I'll be damned. And, man, I'm brain farting a lot today. The guy who played the news director in Anchorman died over the weekend.
I saw that, Fred, isn't it?
Oh my gosh, why am I doing this?
He was talented. He was known for way more than appearing in Anchorman. That would be like 50 out of 50 list of accomplishments.
Okay, first of all, don't insult the man's career. Okay, that's rude. That's rude. When we get back, Dr. Dana Hawkinson with KU Health Systems will be joining us here on the Dana and Parks program. If you have a question for the good doctor, you're welcome to join in. 576-7-
Fred Willard.
Fred Willard. Fred Willard.
Sorry.
Thank you. Thank you. If you put a question mark on the screen, Ron Burgundy will read it. One of the greatest lines ever. Dr. Dana Hawkinson from KU Health Systems joins us on the other side, 576-7798.
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case to loving you. No pills gonna cure my ill. I got a bad case to loving you.
All right, one of our favorites, man. Good friend of the show. He's one of our favorites. Dr. Dana Hawkinson with the University of Kansas Health System is joining us on the hotline. He knows a thing or two about infectious diseases. Doctor, good afternoon, and welcome back.
Not personally. Hi, thank you.
It's good to see you. How are you?
I'm good. It's good to be back.
Well, today we want to give some people some good news, and there was an article over the weekend about new research published Thursday, and I want you to help us understand what it means. This is a case where they took 20 coronavirus patients who have recovered in California, and they looked at their blood. And what did that blood show, doctor?
Well, it showed that there was certainly immunity, and we know that and understand that the immunity is not only with antibodies, and this has to do with also when we have a vaccine, but it's with the T cells. So it's very important when you have an infection that you don't only have antibodies, but you also have cellular immunity. And it certainly showed that you can have, you do induce immunity with the T cells, which is very important in fighting off immunity. Some of the patients, a small amount, you know, 20 to 40 or 60%, may have had some cross-reactivity in their T cells, and they suspected due to just common coronavirus. But we know that a lot of patients, or a lot of people, especially in the United States, have already seen those common coronaviruses, those coronaviruses that we know of that cause the common cough and cold. So that's probably not too unexpected, but we still don't understand the full level of that type of immunity.
And remind people, doctor, what the T cells do. Are those the fighting cells that if you get the virus, the T cells would be dispatched to then fight it?
Yeah, so they're communicators, so they're T helper cells, but there's also cytotoxic T cells. The T helper cells basically help to communicate with the other parts of the immune system and direct the other parts of the immune system by interactions and release of chemicals. And then you have the cytotoxic T cells, which actually help to, say, you know, destroy or kill virus-infected cells to help remove the virus and the infection from our body as well. So there's a couple big aspects of the T cell immunity.
Why do you have to be so smart? And I've been levied for a career of talking about farts. I mean, this is really annoying.
You know, our GI docs like that too, so that's okay. that's what they deal with every day.
So. There's been a lot of talk about, and I was watching a report on CNN, Dr. Hawkinson, about maybe January, maybe July of next year. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's feasible, or is that too quick?
Yeah, you know, there was just some information out recently about a vaccine trial with Moderna, and mm-hmm. they are one of them, the many that are trying to make a vaccine. And it showed, certainly in the small early studies, the vaccine showed good safety, which is the most important thing. Again, we don't want to give you a medicine or a vaccine that's going to cause you harm. So it showed good safety, but it also showed possible efficacy just in the fact that the people who were vaccinated with this drug were actually able to produce antibodies, and antibodies in very good levels. So that's you know, that is very encouraging. You know, we still have to be tempered in our reaction to this, because for things like polio, it took, you know, about 50 years to develop a vaccine. The shortest vaccine from the start to finish was 4 years for mumps, and we still don't have vaccines to very common infections such as RSV. So it's very encouraging, but we still have to continue to do our due diligence, make sure that it's safe and efficacious. But certainly right now those initial results are encouraging.
Well, but one of the things I saw is on this report was that they're going to start full-scale or full-blown, whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. Trials in July. Mm-hmm. Well, we're in mid-May. Why not start them now?
Well, I don't know exactly the details of that. You know, they may have to be able to develop enough of the vaccine so that they can dole those out to get... They also have to do recruiting, so there's a number of steps in the recruiting process as well. You want to make sure that you're getting patients who haven't been already infected, things of that nature. So there's various steps to get to that. There's also, obviously, paperwork. You know, the company is working very closely with the NIH, so a lot of that paperwork and those kind of steps are probably done. But there are still a lot of steps between making sure, again, these were preliminary results, so we want to still make sure that they do the full data analysis to get further results as well.
And then one of the questions I have, doctor, is once they green light this vaccine, once they say, okay, this works, we've gone through the testing, there will be no shortage of volunteers, my guess is, who want to roll their sleeves up and help. Once we have a vaccine, do we even have the infrastructure in place in the United States or wherever these companies are located to then start mass producing this thing by the billions?
Yeah, I think there's a very real concern of will we have enough, and for that reason, you know, in the trial they looked at a couple different doses, you know, 25 micrograms to 100 micrograms. It's a pretty broad range. They may settle on something in between there to, number one, make sure that when they give you the dose that it will be enough to induce immunity, but then also they're using that, you know, maybe middle dose rather than the higher dose, so that they continue to have enough to stretch out the supplies that they have so they can vaccinate as many people as possible. And obviously you're going to have to get plants in production in different countries as well. So there are a lot of steps to get to that and to be able to have enough to vaccinate everybody.
All right, Dr. Dana Hawkinson, can you stick around? You got a few minutes?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Dr. Dana Hawkinson with the University of Kansas Health System. Your calls, if you have a question for Dr. Dana, please call in 576-7798. He can answer it. 576-7798. More of Dana and Parks in just a moment here on KMBZ.
I could stay lost in this moment forever. Every moment spent with you is a moment I treasure.
Day Aerosmith died. The day the movie Armageddon came out. Joining us on the hotline is a good friend of the program, Dr. Dana Hawkinson with the University of Kansas Health System. Hey, if you guys have a question for the doctor regarding coronavirus, you're more than welcome to call in at 576-7798. And the doctor joins us again. I couldn't help but notice, Doctor, that when I went out the other day to the grocery store, which I do believe you have said on multiple occasions, you do not think you'll get the virus in a hospital. You think you'll get it at a grocery store. I could not help but notice how many people were not wearing a mask. And then over the weekend, people were packing into bars in Wisconsin and other places. Do you think people aren't taking this seriously enough, or are they just losing their minds, or, I mean, what's going on?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, grocery store, I just had said that because that's really the only place I was going. But certainly any place in public where you have people who can congregate, whether looking for things at a store, waiting in line, or certainly restaurants and bars, you know, it's pretty concerning this weekend for sure. Down at the on the plaza in the late afternoon, you know, a few weeks ago, I was able to just walk down the middle of 47th Street without any cars. Certainly this weekend, it was quite a bit different. You know, I think it's, again, if we are to able to continue the reopening and improving the economy and letting people work, it's going to be imperative for people to continue to do and be responsible in the ways, in the very easy ways that we have really tried to instruct and help the public, and that is, you know, not going out when you're sick, only go out if you need to, wear your mask, do frequent hand hygiene, but, you know, it's difficult, and everybody wants to get out, and we've been cooped up, and we want to be with friends and loved ones, but we still need to continue to be responsible to do these things.
One of the things I'd like you to comment on, I don't know if you can explain it, from this study out of California, is that the researchers have said they were very surprised to find that some patients, some who have never been exposed to COVID-19, also showed an immune response. Mm-hmm. How can that be? If I've never had it, how can I have some level of immunity against it?
Mm-hmm. And that's what they discuss a little bit in the discussion, where they talk about, again, we know that there are four common cough, cold coronaviruses that we've pretty much all had exposure to. And people in the United States, around 80 to 90% of people will show somewhat of antibodies to those common coronaviruses. What they suspect is there's probably a mild amount of cross-reactivity from those viruses to SARS-CoV-2. Now, again, does that really mean that you have a strong immune reaction to that? It's really unclear, but they really surmise that probably some of that is cross-reactivity to just our common cough and cold viruses, coronaviruses.
Could that be the reason then, that some people get this thing and are completely fine and asymptomatic, and some people get it and are on their deathbed, and no one can figure out why?
You know, it's hard to say. That can certainly be on the table. What we do understand is that a lot of the people, what happens is that immune dysregulation that we're talking about, and is that part of the cause, either having, you know, too much of that or not enough? It's really unclear. So some of our treatment strategies have also involved trying to tamper down the immune reaction and the immune function. So it's really unclear. Those are questions that we are still looking for answers to, and we continue to evaluate that daily. So,
what can you tell us about the children who are getting sick, and what is that reaction?
Yeah, well, the lucky part is that it still is a very small amount of children. Now, if it's someone you know or your child, obviously that's bad. And from the start of this, we have felt pretty lucky in the fact that mostly children have been spared, certainly in the proportions compared to what adults are. So that's a very good thing. But, you know, we have seen a number of cases, 100 or more, in the United States, where children seem to be getting this other sort of immune dysregulation or immune reaction later on. And it's very, it certainly makes them very ill. You know, again, we're lucky that it's a small number of people, but this continues to show us that the things that this virus does, we certainly haven't fully understood. And as we move further into this, these questions will be answered. Hopefully we'll find ways to protect kids, you know, when we know they have the illness, from getting this in the future.
You know, Doctor, one of the saddest things that I've seen since this whole thing started is this drive-by visitation for people who have died. Is that necessary? I mean, why can't we do... Is the body, after it has passed, God forbid, and I'm not trying to sound morbid, mm-hmm. is it contagious? And why can't people go to funerals for people who have died, whether it's from COVID or not, and just social distance at a funeral site?
Yeah. Well, I think there's a couple different answers. So certainly we know that decedents can still be contagious. We know that they can still pass the virus on. However, I would think that after the embalming and the preparation of the body itself, that the virus would be fairly non-infectious. The other issue as far as the funerals, you know, we have to treat that as any other large gathering where you're having people for the most part in close proximity to each other. You have a lot of other high-touch services. You have the time that they're together at the visitation or at the funeral. That also plays a part as well. And so this is just continues to be an abundance of caution to keep people physically distance from each other and try to reduce the chance of, say, a super spreading event like a funeral would be.
I understand that people are sick, and I am. I know Dana is. I mean, everybody's sick of being cooped up at home. Is it just almost a preconceived notion that we need to just go towards herd immunity because a vaccine's not going to happen in the next 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 months?
And what herd immunity really means, Doctor, to our listeners?
Yeah, so in general, you know, we have thought that herd immunity was pretty much, we would say, 80% of the population or more, 90% of the population more, to be really safe. Because even if you have 50% of the population that's immune to any infection, there's still 50% that are able to get the infection and can spread it to the other people who aren't infected. So we really, those numbers have been tempered down a little bit to people saying, well, even 60 to 70% of the population, that may constitute some amount of herd immunity, so that if one person gets infected, there are less and less people that could subsequently be infected. So far, what we know, and again, the experience in New York and other countries and other places around, is that this virus continues to be very contagious. We know that although 80% of people or more do very well and don't have to go to the hospital and don't have to seek medical attention, we know that when you have a high number of people infected, even a very small percentage of that number will cause a high number of people to be sick and critically ill and even die. And so even getting to herd immunity, you know, we have a very small number or percentage of the population in America infected right now. If we were to get to that 60 and 70%, which people are expecting, as we expect this virus to be here, that will just be immense numbers of infections overall, right? And with that, even a small number is just an immense number of continued, death and destruction and critical illness in its path.
Sam, I know we're up against the break, but do we have one caller with a question?
We did,
and then they dropped. That's okay.
All right. Hey, Dr. Hawkinson, stand by. I have a question when we get back about the disparity between the United States and South Korea that I've heard a lot about. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can weigh in on that. We'll continue with Dr. Dana Hawkinson. If you have a question for him, 576-7798 with the University of Kansas Health System. 576-7798 here on Dana and Parks.
I've been waiting on the sunset, bills on my mindset, I can't deny it, getting higher than my income, income's breadcrumbs,
right, so I've been trying to survive. Because this has been a topic of conversation with me and a couple others over the weekend. And Dr. Dana Hawkinson with the University of Kansas Health System is joining us on the hotline. And he's been so generous with his time over the last two months or so. So, doctor, let me read you some statistics here. In South Korea, which showed their first coronavirus positive test on the same day as the United States, they have had 263 deaths. The United States is now at 89,000. Now, and in fairness, I want to be clear here, the United States has 6 times the population of South Korea. But we've had 89,000 deaths. They've had 263. In the capital city of Seoul, they have had 4 deaths. Now, are they underreporting or are they doing something different that we're not doing?
We certainly know that there are a lot of caveats in there. Again, you had mentioned one of the biggest ones is the population disparity, the size. There are also cultural differences in the fact that certainly I think in Asian countries it has been much more readily used as far as face masks, so people are using face masks more readily. We know that you can spread the disease while being asymptomatic, so not even having symptoms. There are also probably infrastructure issues there with public health infrastructure and ability to contact, trace, and test more readily. Certainly, I know that they had been, at one point, had a larger amount of testing per capita compared to the United States. So I think there are so many details there and differences, and that is why, they were able to do what they were have done also, but in contrast to kind of what our experience here, I think there's just so many different reasons for that.
What have some of the other countries done because they're ahead of us as far as in their numbers and how many weeks they've been dealing with it versus the United States? What are some of the lessons we can learn based on other countries' experience?
Yeah, I think the first one is our public health infrastructure. I think that for some time, and Dr. Norman alluded to this a couple weeks ago, our public health infrastructure in the United States in general has not been as optimal as it could be. I think, when you get into a pandemic, any problems you have, whether that's socioeconomic, health disparities, anything like that, are noticed more. And so we certainly have seen that. They are exaggerated, I think, and that is what we are seeing with the public health infrastructure as far as that goes, the ability to test the people that we need to be testing, the ability to do contact tracing, the ability to have the tests available. So I think that is one of the big takeaways.
Doctor, do you wear a mask when you're in public?
I do. I started a couple weeks ago. Yep. Wearing them out to the grocery stores, and any other stores that I go to, I have started. I think it's good. Again, it's not for protection for me. It's to protect other people from me, should I have it and not know that I have it.
But you were talking about the cultural aspect regarding some East Asian countries. Do you think this is going to become our new normal?
Wearing, you know, I very well could.
Wearing masks in public?
Yeah, I think at least for the foreseeable future, it could and should. And I understand about freedoms, and we respect freedom more than anything in this country. But we also understand, and one of the tenets and pillars of this country is that we stand up and fight for people who can't fight for themselves. And so by wearing the mask, and that shows that you are doing that for other people who may be in more vulnerable populations. And so I think for the time being, a mask is probably going to be part of our culture in doing that, and again, to protect other people, and so that we can continue to be able to and move towards the things that we want to be able to do, like go to restaurants, go to bars, go to sporting events and concerts.
You know, we're even seeing like the plexiglass go up at all kinds of places, like the grocery stores, the bank, where you go in as a customer and there's now plexiglass separating you from the workers. I've said this before. I think that that's something that should stick around, and it'll be interesting to see if things like flu rates go down, if transmission of other viruses go down, because we're starting to do these other things for coronavirus.
Yeah, I think that's certainly an early rumbling or expectation is that, you know, along with flu vaccination, which everybody should be getting in the fall and the winter, all of these other measures with really focusing on hand hygiene and some of these other measures that we're taking, the physical distancing, that will actually hopefully help and reduce influenza and other respiratory virus rates when we get into the respiratory viral season.
You've been watching The Last Dance on ESPN?
No, I'm going to probably binge them all. You know, I was a huge
fan
of the Bulls back then, so yeah. I will be.
You're going to love
busy.
It, man.
He's been busy with infectious disease stuff.
I forgot. You're fighting a pandemic. I'm sorry.
Eventually, I'll binge them all at once. I'm going to do that. So.
Well, you're going to love it, Doctor. Hey, we always appreciate your time, and you were so generous with it. Thank you so much. You definitely need a haircut. Let me know, and we'll get you set up. Okay? I'm looking
that
at you right
good.
Now on the Zoom. You need a haircut badly.
I cut it myself. I cut the front.
I noticed. That's why I said you need a haircut badly.
That's why I'm on radio, because it doesn't really matter.
That's why Scott's on radio, too.
That's all right.
Be well and be safe, my friend, and thank you for your time.
You're too.
The greatest. Thank you
thank
so
you.
Much.
Take care.
All right. That is Dr. Dana Hawkinson with the University of Kansas Health System here on Dana and Parks. The news is next.
Thanks for listening to the Dana and Parks podcast. Remember, you can catch us online anytime at KMBZ.com.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.